Again, if you want program with our Senior Vice President Services. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. This is the start of the new GTLD program status. Please welcome Kurt Pritz, Senior Vice President ICANN.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. Thanks very much for coming. All the way to Cartagena and then spending time at this session. This is the first of three new GTLD sessions today. Luckily for you, you know, I won't be in front of you for most of it. As a matter of fact, later on today, there are sessions about the overarching issues and our progress on those, where the community will be able to talk directly to board members. And then similarly, after that, there's a session on the still controversial objection process for morality and public order issues, where again a set of board members will come and understand the progress that's been made and interact directly with those that are attending that meeting. So those will be excellent opportunities to speak directly to the board and convey your sense of satisfaction or dismay. So this is probably my seventh presentation about this. You know, I have a job where I've become somewhat knowledgeable in trademark protection and root zone stability, so I think I'm almost prepared to launch my own supporting organization or advisory committee. So what's the agenda? What are we going to talk about today? Well, we're going to talk about the proposed final applicant guidebook, so those are new words for us, so we'll talk a little bit about what that means, and we'll talk about the changes from the previous version of the guidebook. As Rod and others explained, the guidebook is the instruction manual for applying for new top-level domains. So we'll discuss the changes that are made. And Karen Lentz of ICANN, who primarily wrote the guidebook and is instrumental in this process, will present that portion. We'll talk a little bit about the evaluation itself. We'll start to bring the community up to speed on how applications will be evaluated, particularly the flow of data and the safeguards there, and how we're going to measure success, because that's very important for improving upon the process. And then some about the key issues that are remaining, although, as I said, there's some other sessions on that scheduled for later. So what is a proposed final guidebook? It's intended to solve the problem of publishing a guidebook and having the board be able to consider it for potential approval while still allowing public comment. It seems unfathomable that we would post a final guidebook and say we're not taking comment anymore because the board's going to vote on it. The community, our community, would find a way to vote or to comment anyway. And so we hit on this model that we use for the ICANN budget, where we post the ICANN budget and we take comment right up until when the board votes on the budget. So it can consider comment, change the budget if it wants to, kick it back if it wants to. So we thought using that model of a proposed final guidebook would work here. So the board and staff will take in comments during the week. We're preparing comment summaries of the board starting today on a daily basis for what's put in the comment form. So your comments entered into the comment form will be summarized and put before the board daily. It's also important to recognize that as a result of the comments, the guidebook's going to change. How the heck can you call it a final guidebook if it's going to change? Well, I think the guidebook's always going to change. We're always going to seek to improve the process. Just the other day, a registry constituency member said, I think you have a mistake in your SLA. It's going to make things very difficult. Well, the board voting on the guidebook, whether they do or not, would not foreclose change. We'll continue to take comment and make changes as necessary. If it's a big change, we'll come back to the community and say, hey, we want to make a big change. But the guidebook will continue to be a living document. So the bottom line here is that, the process launch date is to be determined, but, the guidebook itself is complete and ready to launch. And how did this all get started? There's a few new people in here, I suppose. It started before ICANN with the white paper and the green paper that were the genesis of the formation of ICANN. And in that, one of the few objectives for the new organization was to develop a process for creating competition in the registry in the top-level domain space in a secure, stable manner that brings net benefit to the Internet community and the community at large. In preparation for that, many of you know we held trial rounds in 2000 and 2004 where we introduced 7 top-level domains in each one of those rounds, went to school on those. There was a lot of lessons learned from those rounds, certainly. And then the GNSO set upon the policy development for this set and issued and got approved by the board a set of 19 policy recommendations accompanied by principles, implementation guidelines, and the like. That was approved by the board, and that set into action this set of meetings we've been having over the last couple years, where we've posted versions of the guidebook or excerpts of the guidebook for public comment. I think one of the real victories for the ICANN model here is how the community worked on several key issues of the guidebook. So with the publication of Guidebook 1, several issues were raised. The community formed several working groups highlighted here, and Rod, mentioned the increase of acronyms to the ICANN lexicon somewhat incredibly. And so those included, the IRT and the STI on trademark issues, the ZFA and the HSTLD on malicious conduct issues, the application support working group. We're going to hear from Avery as part of this presentation on the work that group is doing to work for the support of applicants, vertical integration, morality, and public order. All those working groups formed and did an incredible amount of work in a short period of time and produced very credible work product, and it's all reflected in the guidebook. I'm going to go back because I just want to tell you where we're going. Where are we going? Well, we've produced a final version of the guidebook. Posted online was a timeline of the board that directed by the board where it indicated it would consider this proposed final guidebook here for a possible approval. We're going to listen to the community, see how that goes, and then the board will make a decision. We've developed a comprehensive communications campaign in order to ensure that at the end of the launch, somebody in some region of the world raises their hand and says, gee, I didn't know about this. It's a very lofty and kind of impossible goal, but we're looking to ramp up our current communications in a fairly intensive four-month campaign to ensure that potential registries, registrants who might take advantage of them, trademark owners who need to protect their brands are all aware of the process. And this will all lead up to the program launch. So where are we? Here's where we are, I think. After an intensive policy development process and the first guidebook was written, we in this room and those of us who couldn't make it here sat down and developed a fairly comprehensive set of issues that we identified as the overarching issues. In addition to that, we identified a few more big issues along the way: vertical integration, how the marketplace should be configured, and certain other implementation issues, and did a lot of community work that I described just before. That I just find that to be highly commendable, and it resulted in a generation of answers and solutions for the guidebook that many of us think has resulted in a guidebook with pretty darn hardened processes, definitely a new set of standardized trademark protections intended to mitigate the cost of defensive trademarks, or the value of defensive registration, or mitigate the value of defensive registration, so you can balance that either way. 10 mitigation conduct measures are in the guidebook. A lot of discussion so that new TLDs can be launched in a stable manner that will bring innovation, benefit. What did the minister say before? You know, we want to eliminate poverty, create jobs, and increase competition. Those were pretty cool words at the end of that. So what are we going to do here? We're going to listen and improve, and in the meantime, we're ready, we think, to launch a timely, orderly, and predictable process. And just to reflect some of the change that I just want to indicate for you the amount of change that has occurred in the guidebook as a result of the community activity. So last time we did this with the registry agreement, and I wanted to demonstrate how much change has gone through that. So you can just scroll through that as fast as you can, like much faster. And I just want you to catch the, there's a lot of pages in the guidebook. So I just want you to catch the amount of red that, that's really fast, that is in the guidebook. That's in the guidebook. So I'm going to rest my voice for a second, and you can just go through it. So you're still in Module 1, so I guess going fast is a good idea. But Module 2 is how applications are validated. That's still Module 2. It isn't. Yay. Okay, we're only going to take a minute more of your time. But I found this really impressive. Karen just did this last night, so we didn't know how it was going to come out. If anybody makes a comment on any of these changes, I'll be impressed. So while that goes on, I'm going to bring up Karen Lenz, who's going to discuss the changes made to the guidebook so far.
Okay, thank you. I will be taking you through the part of this session where we cover what's been updated in the guidebook since the last version we published, which was draft version 4. And so I'll review briefly the changes that we made between that version and the version that's up for discussion now, the proposed final version. The guidebook, as you may know, is organized according to module. Each of the modules corresponds essentially to one phase of the process. So module 1 covers the application process, the requirements, what happens to an application, what stages it goes through once it's submitted. Module 2 covers the evaluation procedures, so the scoring and criteria that each application goes through. Module 3 covers objection and dispute resolution procedures that occur in the event that a formal objection is lodged against a particular application. Module 4 covers string contention, which is about what happens when there's more than one qualified application for a particular TLD or for very similar TLDs. And Module 5 takes you through the last stages of the process where a successful applicant enters into a registry agreement with ICANN and then goes on to have the TLD delegated. So I'll go through each of those modules and highlight the few changes that have been in each. So that can help you locate if you're looking for a particular one, where to find it. So module 1, there are a few changes here. And the first one is new information that was added on batching, delegation rates, and dependencies for root scaling. Batching is really a contingency plan for what happens in the event that the volume of applications is so high that the process, as it's been built, can't accommodate it. So it covers how we would establish processing order in that case. The other pieces of that, delegation rates and dependencies on root scaling, which you'll hear about a little bit more, is one of the issues discussed throughout the process. And the new information that's been included is informed by some work that's been done to look at the process and estimate, various scenarios of numbers of applications and how many we think could realistically come out of the process on the other side. And that has implications for how many could actually end up being delegated within a given time period. So that information has been included in Module 1 for reference. The next couple of items here have to do with eligibility. The first one, previously there were some restrictions on eligibility for registrars. Most of those restrictions have been eliminated, so there's an update on that. That's in accordance with the board's recent direction on that topic. And then the second area of eligibility that's been updated has to do with the background screening criteria. There's in this version a lot more detail about the criteria that is going to be used for that. It focuses on just two areas, essentially the criminal history or business trust violations or cyber squatting activities that the applicant may have been involved in the past. So the background screening looks at those two areas. There's also in Module 1 kind of a placeholder for what we expect to be some resources to be available for applicants who need or require or are requesting support of different types to be able to submit a GTLD application. So there's a place in Module 1 with the expectation that those will be able to include those resources once they're recommended, and you'll hear a little bit more about that in this session also. Finally, in Module 1, there's some information on IDN variant strings, and that section has been somewhat expanded in detail to give more clarity on what happens to variants in a few different scenarios. Okay, Module 2, in the evaluation, there are a couple of changes here. One has to do with the string requirements that are in place for all GTLD strings that are applied for. That's been updated in accordance with some revisions to RFC 1123 that are occurring in the IETF. So those have been updated. Simple way to say it is that it eliminates the possibility of using numbers in an ASCII TLD string. The other one is part of the geographic names review. The one of the parts of that has to do with what happens with an application for a continent or region. And there are a few reference lists used in the geographic names section. So the additional list is the UNESCO list of regions that's been included as a reference in the case of a continent or region name. Okay, Module 3 again covers objections and dispute resolution. There are four possible grounds for objection. Three of them are discussed here as having been changed. The first one is the legal rights objection that is has been updated to incorporate protections for IGOs for their names and acronyms to be pursued via the legal rights objection process. The another grounds for objection is the community objection. With that, there are a number of factors given that a panel weighs in making determinations on those objections. Part of that included a complete defense for a case where the applicant could meet the standing requirements. That's something that we've gotten a lot of comment on throughout the various drafts of the guidebook. And so in this version, we've eliminated that. We've balanced that elimination with a strengthening of the standard for a successful community objection. And then the last bullet there has to do with the morality and public order objection process. There is a community working group that has been discussing various points of implementation advice for how we do that. And Module 3 has been updated with a number of their recommendations, and there's more detail on those, I think, later in this session as well. Before I get to 5, Module 4, as I said, covers string contention procedures. That's pretty stable, so there's nothing really significant changing there. Finally, Module 5 has some new detail on what the board's role is in the approval of GTLD applications, what their role is in the process. That, again, is something that was requested quite a bit in comments. There was some clarity on how that part of the process would work, so that's been added. The last three points there are requirements in the registry agreement. So these would be applicable to all new GTLD registry operators. The first one, the trademark clearinghouse, registries are required to offer certain launch services that rely on data that's been submitted to the trademark clearinghouse. Part of that model was the concept of substantive review of trademarks. This is in accordance with comments that's been given some more definition and detail in this version. The URS, Uniform Rapid Suspension Service or System, has also been updated slightly. This is a requirement for all new GTLD registry operators to implement. The change here, the major change, is the shortening of the response time period for a URS complaint to 14 days, and that's with the intention of keeping with a rapid process. And finally, the registry agreement has a new specification 9, which contains a code of conduct that would be required of all new GTLD operators. That is has been put in place as a result of the changes in cross-ownership provisions. So it covers things like data protection, use of data, and other issues. Okay, that concludes my review. I'd like to invite Avery Doria to come up. Avery is going to give an update on the discussions of the applicant support working group. And following that, Kurt will come up and resume the session.
Thank you. The applicant support has been work that's been done in conjunction. It's been basically a cross-community working group between ALAC and the GNSO. And basically, the problem was given to us. It was initially put on the agenda, as it were, by GAC, saying, and so what kind of support is there for people from developing economies who basically find the ideas of 185,000 rate as a bit prohibitive, and including with some of the other points. So the group has been meeting now for several months and has basically come to a consensus on a report that has been published. It's the background report. It has actually been published in all six languages, so hopefully people can read it and comment and hopefully support it. The first part is basically we established who should receive support. And the most fundamental of the requirements that was listed is a need criteria. So basically, it's first and foremost, it's people who have a need, people who cannot enter this process without getting some help. Then after that, once the need was established, and part of the work that we haven't done yet is actually defining what indeed is need and how does one basically determine that, how is that dealt with, and that's a work item that the board has come back to us and said, interesting, you know, please do more work, please tell us what you mean by that and how someone would figure that out. Then once need has been established, there's basically a set of either other criteria that define what it is. So they should be NGOs or nonprofit organizations or other not-for-profit type organizations, service organizations perhaps. Now, one of the problems that we got, one of the answers that we got from, for example, Afrala was, in a lot of developing countries, being a nonprofit isn't always possible, so can you make some allowance for entrepreneurs? And so included is entrepreneurs in those markets where the market constraints and conditions make normal business operations more difficult. Other traits that we're looking for in those that would be supported are those that are community-based applications, those that are applicants in emerging economies being a primary, and applicants in languages who aren't represented on the internet yet. Now, the kinds of aid that we're recommending be supported, kinds of support we're recommending, is that there be cost reduction. There are several costs within the 185,000 that seem unreasonable to the people working in this group in terms of applying them to people from developing economies. For example, the cost of developing this program or some of the risk amortization for the program, that those costs don't necessarily, to the people in this group, seem that they should be paid for by people in developing economies. We're also looking for working with other funding organizations to see if we can't bring other forms of funding in to assist with the payment of the fees. There's modifications to the financial continued operation instrument that says you need a certain number of years of escrow in terms of running it, and we're basically suggesting that for these, you know, a 6 to 12 month may be sufficient. There's logistical support, which includes primarily, you know, translation and help in understanding how to fill out these application forms and such. There's technical support. Now, one of the things to be clear is that we are not suggesting a lower technical threshold. What we're suggesting is that in meeting some of the technical threshold, help could be provided by those that understand how to do it, by those who have V6 connectivity, for those who might live in an area that does not have V6 and connectivity. And then also we're looking for exception to the rules requiring separation of registry and registrar, looking for perhaps exceptions to the rule that says you have to use a registrar to register a name when you're in an IDN script in a territory where there perhaps are no registrars that are supporting that particular script, that particular language. How can you be a registry if you can't find a registrar? So basically looking at those kinds of exceptions. Last thing I have to say, that was my two slides, is that we will have a much more in-depth meeting on this on Thursday where we'll go into this, and we'll be inviting you all to comment and to give recommendations and advice. So thank you.
Thank you, Aubrey. That was great. So I'm going to talk on a couple more issues. One is getting ready a little bit for new GTLDs and managing the process. So if you could go, I go on to the next slide. I forgot. So we call that operational readiness. And really, there's two kinds of operational readiness, right? There's the kind where ICANN and its partners are getting ready to manage the process of evaluating applications. So procedures have been written and processes have been developed. An online system is not quite finished but is in testing. Evaluation panels are panel service providers have been selected. Contract negotiations are going on. Then evaluation panels will be stocked with evaluators. We're forming a small customer service function in order to be able to be responsive to those who were paying $185,000 to get their application evaluated. We have to work with partners in delegation, right? We work with VeriSign and the NTIA in delegating domain names. They're part of the operational readiness equation. And then, you know, how are we doing? So we want to be able to measure the success of the program, the success of our evaluation, et cetera. On the other side of ICANN, it's business as usual, but there's a requirement for increased compliance capability and span in order to address the needs of additional registries. Registry Liaison, IANA, all have to be expanded. There's an operating plan in place that describes how that happens numerically. And then other bits of ICANN need to get a little bit bigger, too. I thought it'd be interesting, and it's probably the next debate we're all going to have about the flow of data. So there's a lot of data associated with every application, and certainly how that data is handled, it's sensitive data, and how that data is handled is very important. Something I'm not going to talk about are security measures because I'm not smart enough. But we can get somebody who's smart enough to explain that when you want. But I'm going to talk a little bit about who gets what data. So the information in an application will flow from the applicant into the TAS, which is the TLD application support system. Application system. And I really like that acronym, but we're stuck with it. And then it'll flow to evaluation panels and back and forth in evaluation panels. There's an interplay of issues, so there's a great deal of complexity that can't be described in that box or in a font that would be visible up on that screen. The evaluators and dispute resolution providers also need access to public comment, so that's a part of this information flow. And then finally, the public will see a good portion of this information. It's a transparent process, but intended to keep sensitive or security-related information from the public. So in the bottom of the slide, which is or will be posted, there's details about what the public will see, which questions that they'll see, the objections when they're made, status reports, evaluation summaries will be posted, the executed agreements will be posted, and so on. So the public will see that. And this is a little bit of an eye chart, but you can take it and look later. So, you know, who will have access to what information? So it shows the question groupings in the application and what will be made available to who. So, for example, a good bit of or all of the financial answers to financial questions will remain confidential. The security measures undertaken by a registry, the efforts they're going to describe how they're going to maintain secure operations, that will remain confidential. So you can kind of take this Rosetta Stone and lay it up against the questions and see and make judgments. And, you know, this, like I said, I think this is an important part of the discussion we have with the community to ensure we're, you know, fulfilling our transparency and accountability requirements, but protecting, you know, confidential information. And at the end, that contributes to DNS stability, too. Then we want to measure success. And, you know, we're, of course, we're not just thinking about measuring success now. It'd be a little bit too late after the process is designed. So we want to measure success of the new TLD process, you know, against the original goals set out in the policy development document that was approved by the board and also the affirmation of commitments. So we want to put into place, we want to develop metrics, or we're developing metrics that attempt to measure success against each one of these goals. Some of them are quite lofty and speculative and difficult to quantify, but nonetheless, we want to measure ourselves not, you know, against our own internal goals, but against the goals that the community set for us in these two and other published agreements. So when can that evaluation occur? Well, some of it can occur now, because we have a guidebook that we think is close to finish, and we can work with the community to test how that guidebook implemented the policy recommendations. And this won't be a new discussion, right? We have this discussion every darn meeting. Staff meets with the GNSO, says here's progress as a check to see if we're implementing the process according to the policy. We formed the SDI group to ensure that trademark protections were in line with existing approved policy. So we can start evaluating our work and create a report on how well we've implemented policy and the process for doing that right now. Right as soon as we launch, we can start evaluating ourselves against our goals with regard to how we process applications. You know, was the process operated in a predictable and transparent manner? Did we provide good customer service? Did we meet or exceed financial goals? I don't know if exceeding financial goals means we spend too much money or less money than planned, but one of those. And take some sort of overall customer satisfaction. And then finally, you know, in accordance with the AOC, we'll measure the market impacts in accordance with the requirements described there. That's 1 year after the delegation of new TLD, so about, you know, 2 years from the launch of the process. So we'll have success measures each step of the way that we'll collaborate with the community on. So I hope that's helpful. I'm just going to get back to key issues for a bit because I thought that would be a good precursor to open up a question and answer period. So as you know, we identified four overarching issues with the publication of the first applicant guidebook. You know, that is whether, you know, with regard to root stability, whether the nearly simultaneous introduction of new GTLDs and IDNs, IPv6, and the signing of the root zone would affect root zone performance. They're all very important ICANN initiatives, and they all kind of came to fruition at the same time. The other is economic studies. You know, try as best we can to quantify the costs and benefits associated with new GTLDs. Will the new GTLD program as envisioned bring net benefits to the community? Net benefits meaning, you know, more benefit than detriment. With regard to trademark protection, you know, one of the implementation recommendations initially was that there be no consistent or required trademark protection mechanisms in the guidebook, but that registries could adopt their own. And working hard with the community, and really the community doing the work, developed a set of trademark protections that have been incorporated into the guidebook. And then finally, malicious conduct. There's malicious conduct in the DNS now, right? So how do we work to ensure that we actually hope to mitigate opportunities for malicious conduct by putting into place measures to prevent that? So So take the opportunity of this reconfiguration of the space to actually get away from the so-called Wild West and into a DNS architecture and environment that's more secure for TLD registrants and users and domain name registrants and trademark holders. So the overall approach to these issues was consult with the commenters and, you know, essentially seek expert advice. And I've already said a few times during the ceremony about the, or during this presentation, about the formation of some very important community-based groups that develop solutions for each one of these, where we publish relevant reports, we put stuff in the guidebook, and continue to discuss implementation proposals. Going forward, what are we going to do? Well, most important, we want to monitor the effectiveness of these measures. So as an example, in working with economists, we asked them to quantify the effectiveness of new trademark protections, and the answer is, well, we can't. It's very speculative, and that's not really surprising. So what's really important is to measure those, the success of those measures, and augment them or change them in a way that maximizes the benefit to the whole community. So, you know, I have some slides here that are going to be repetitive because I talked too much during the first slide about this. But, and I want you to know that we're going to have a session regarding overarching issues after this. So you can ask questions to me, and I will, and our staff will answer them best they can. And then, but you're going to get another opportunity to pose questions to board members. So you might want to think about which questions you might want to ask us and which questions you might want to pose later for board members. So two bites at the apple, probably most valuable later without me. But the gravamen of the root stability discussion has been that, in fact, the introduction of new TLDs will be rate limited. 1,000 TLDs a year sounds like a fantastic number. We really expect, you know, the numbers say 215 to 245 delegations per year based on the expected amount of applications. But even if we receive infinitely many applications, the process of evaluating them is rate limited so that less than 1,000 TLDs will be delegated a year. This, in discussions anyway, this has caused some, resulted in some comfort among those who are concerned with stability of the DNS. So do you hear that buzzing? You think that's my phone? I shouldn't have this on anyway, right? So economic study phase two. So just released, you know, we welcome comments about timing as well as substance because it's very important that everybody gets a chance to read and consider it. I'll tell you, the board they've been commanded to read it, not by me. And the board is having a work session on Wednesday to discuss what they read in the economic status report. I'm not going to discuss comment because I think it's for you to read, but, you know, it does empirical studies as advertised, i.e. uses the past as a prologue, uses the experiences of existing TLDs to forecast what we might see in the future, to discuss whether or not there'd be competition in the pure generic TLD space, what are the benefits and successes or not successes of restricted TLDs, community-based TLDs, IDNs, what are the frequency of defensive registration and the effectiveness of past trademark protection mechanisms, and what might be the effects of new TLDs on the ease of navigation, you know, the benefits to users, what the establishment of .brand as a trusted site, what's the effects on domain name scarcity? Is there any issue really there now or not? The report also difficults the difficulty of judging future developments. Innovation is difficult or impossible to forecast, as are the effectiveness of the trademark protections and malicious conduct mitigations that we've created especially for this process. With regard to rights protection, this is just a graphic of the suite of trademark protections that are being implemented in this process. There's trademark protections that address registry services before launch, the requirement for a TLD to have either an IP claims or a sunrise period. And those services will be facilitated by a clearinghouse. Trademark holders only need to register a name once in the clearinghouse for all new TLDs. And then there's a suite of protections after uniform rapid suspension, which is a cheaper, faster method of UDRP, but with a only for clear-cut cases of abuse. There's a post-delegation dispute process so that if there's significant trademark violation by the registry after delegation, there's remedy there, and there's also the implementation of Thick Whiz. So these are a suite of protections that were not in place before. How effective will they be? How effective will they be in trademark holders examining their situation, saying we don't need to make defensive registrations? That will be really the test, if they'll lower costs overall for trademark holders. Luckily, I'm not going to read all these, but these are all malicious conduct mitigation solutions that are inserted into the guidebook. There's one exception, the high security TLD. There's still work going on there for what's going to be a voluntary program that's operated independently of ICANN. But the rest are pretty much baked. There's a new malicious conduct mitigation measure this time. We'll talk about vertical integration in a moment, but what's included to help prevent data abuses is a registry code of conduct. So, consulted with the experts in the industry, developed this suite of protections and implemented them in the guidebook. Are we done? I didn't know we were going there. But are we done? Of course the answer is no. There's a lot more work that can be done in order to improve the namespace. And the question is, is all this on the critical path to launching a new TLD process, or will we continue to evolve the space and make it better as we grow, as we measure the effectiveness of what we're doing now and make it better? So we can undertake policy developments to amend WHOIS requirements, to require registrant verification, eliminate or enhance privacy or proxy services. We can work hard, maybe without policy development, but just to implement a WHOIS tool that will accommodate IDNs with good information, implement root zone monitoring to ensure ongoing root zone stability, and like I said, with the availability of real data, we'll be able to affect change and continue to make it better. So I urge you to come to the overarching issues meeting this afternoon. I think it's going to be good. So there's just two more issues I want to talk about, and then you can ask questions if you want. One is the dreaded VI, vertical integration. It's a very important issue to I think all users, and particularly those interested in acquiring a top-level domain, who can apply for a top-level domain? It's one of the questions the GNSO set out to answer in its policy development. We received expert economic advice on two. We received serious reports on vertical integration or vertical separation on two occasions. There have been numerous proposals described for attacking this issue. We had a GNSO working group convened and worked mightily to develop different alternatives. And so at the end of the day, the board voted to allow cross-ownership. It decided not to become a regulator of the marketplace where they thought the regulations might be ineffective or expensive, but instead separated the issue of vertical integration from data abuse. So if there's an increased potential for data abuse by a combined registrar, well, let's address that. Let's not interfere with the market. Let's address that through a registry code of conduct and additional compliance and enforcement mechanisms. So what was the rationale? There's been discussion at this meeting already about what was the rationale for the board making those decisions. In seeking to publish the information right away and get news out, the board wrote one of the more complex, detailed sets of whereas clauses, because that's how the board communicates with the community right away, and posted that. So while more analysis and reporting of the board thinking will be published, I invite you to read the board resolution on vertical integration, where it says it needed to rely on a factual basis for the decision. So it relied on the economic advice given in two very serious reports, got legal advice, and, of course, did a lot of listening to the community, as you know. You know, I just want to pause here because the board has spent days and days of time considering this issue, working very hard, and I could talk a lot about that, but literally hundreds of hours personally working on understanding these very complex issues. So, unpause. The GNSO Vertical Integration Group didn't get to a consensus, so the board points out that because the board would have adopted a consensus position of the GNSO. Noted that current agreements are negotiated individually, so there is no real historical prohibition on that. So this, so there is some rationale for this decision. It's already published, and there's more to come. And then a couple more points. So what are the new enforcement mechanisms associated with these integrated entities? Well, there's a code of conduct prohibiting misuse of data. Read it. It's the very last page of the base agreement. More robust auditing requirements, graduated sanctions, and ICANN's right to refer issues to competition authorities where they need be. So a comprehensive set of data protections. I just want to say one word about compliance, because there's a lot of discussion about ICANN's contractual compliance department and its actions, effectiveness, and need to build up. So while admittedly there's three open recs in the compliance department, those are being filled, and there is a detailed plan for how compliance is going to grow with the launch of new GTLDs. But in the meantime, the department continues to operate very effectively and at ever higher standards. And so, for example, during the period from August to November, the compliance department sent out 1,600 enforcement notices, 1,600 notices that says, you're in breach, buddy. You better do something about it. And historically, 75% of the breaches are cured through these first compliance notices. Follow-up notices get another 75%. So by the end of the day, we're sending few breach notices out and doing relatively few contract notifications. But, you know, divide 1,600 by the number of working days in that period, and you'll see quite a robust function. And I just want to point out most of the notices are about transfers and who is. A number of registrars are being terminated. The number is going down a little bit because we've ended a comprehensive effort to clean up registrars who are not escrowing data, who haven't complied with that requirement, or not complying with some really clear registrar requirements. So we undertook a six-month effort that bridged the 2 years and wound up terminating a number of registrars. So, you know, under John's leadership, the compliance department is going to do a better job of describing this kind of data so they can brag about what they've done. So back to new GTLDs and the last issue, which is morality and public order. This has always been a contentious issue, and there's been lots of discussion about it with no real concrete suggestions how to improve the existing implementation model. So in the last few months, across SOAC working group, you know, GAC, GNSO, ALAC, others have convened this cross-constituency working group that I think is a powerful model for ICANN to come in considering these questions to provide implementation, not policy guidance, on addressing culturally objectionable or sensitive strings. The idea wasn't to revisit the policy. In the guidebook, we've adopted seven of the recommendations of this working group. One is to change the name of the thing. So we're not sure this is the right name, so it's in brackets, and wish to talk about it, but it's called the Limited Public Interest Objection. And it incorporates new additional treaties recommended by the group, clarifies how we rely on principles of international law. It identifies a couple new processes. One, for encouraging applicants to pre-identify potentially sensitive strings, and also a new mechanism where governments can provide a notification without objecting to applicants where they deem the application might be sensitive. We've also incorporated the fact that the panel making the decision can consider the string and also consider the purpose of the TLD and provide a lot more detail about aspects of the process. So there's some rubs left, and we're going to have a session about this late, if you can make it tonight, 5 o'clock or something like that. What are we going to talk about? What's the board role? The policy guidance is to create an independent dispute resolution process for considering these goals with the people with the expertise that resolve disputes and resolve disputes brought by governments and resolve disputes in these sorts of areas. The working group also seeks to broaden the standards, i.e. allow more objections for morality and public order. So a discussion is needed around there because I don't think there's agreement on where the differences are, let alone what the differences should be. And then who should have standing to base on community objections? And this is, you know, it would just take 5 minutes to describe why I'm talking about community objections in morality and public order. But come to the session this afternoon, and you'll have fun. So do not miss any of these. The overarching issues discussion this afternoon, followed by the morality and public order discussion. Tuesday, there's a new TLD basics discussion for our presentation for newcomers. Wednesday, we're all having panelists that are bringing their experience in developing the process, community participants, advising you how to get ready for TLDs. If you're going to apply for one, how to get ready. If you're a trademark holder, how to get ready. If you're not going to apply for one, how you might take advantage of things. So that's a good session. And then Thursday, per Avery's good talk before, we're going to talk about assisting GTLD applicants. So at the end, we're going to continue to listen and improve, but we're ready to launch what we think is a timely, orderly, and predictable process. So with that, I'll close and take questions from the floor, and we have a group of really knowledgeable ICANN staff that can help me answer questions when I can't. So thank you very much. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Kurt. My name is Ken Stubbs. I've got just a couple of questions. First of all, clarification on the schedules. When will we actually have, when is the public session with the new GTLD, the DAG, with the board? Is that this afternoon, tomorrow, Wednesday, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. So at 15:30 this afternoon, we're going to talk about overarching issues. There will be some board members in that discussion, a few. And at 5:30 tonight, there'll be this morality and public order discussion. There'll be board members in that one. So those are the two with board members.
Okay. A couple questions on comments that you made and a couple of concerns. You left the impression early on that this is still, even though the DAG may very well be substantially approved by the board, there may be some carve-outs or some continuing parts of the DAG that will you'll be accepting comments on, not only accepting comments, but are open to discussion for modification. There are some issues in the, first of all, one of the issues that there are concerns over are the escrow requirements. This could penalize many communities there, I believe is a 3-year requirement there. And I think we need to revisit that and look at the economic impact on both the small communities and how we can help deal with those issues, as well as taking the other side of the coin where you have people who have been doing this for many, many years and have a very strong financial background and operational background. Another one of the issues that I would like to point out would be the questions. There are some issues in the contractual agreement with regard to pricing policies and so forth. I'm somewhat concerned about that because, as you know, ICANN is trying to move away from being involved in pricing issues, and I think we need to have as much flexibility in dealing with those pricing issues, and I think that we need to have the opportunity to discuss that with you a little bit more. There are some other issues that the registry constituency will be pointing out in a small one-and-a-half-page caveat. We'd like to have you take a look at that. And we just need some sort of comfort in knowing that the board is not approving necessarily the registry agreement as outlined in the DAG and that they're still willing to discuss some of those issues. Thank you.
So is that 1.5 pages in really big font or really small font?
48 points.
So more seriously, I'm aware of some of those issues. Brian Cute came to me and described some of them that are important because we don't want to enforce SLAs that are onerous or overly expensive for the benefit you get. And I think we have the same spirit of an agreement in principle on pricing, but if you're not reading what we're thinking it says in the agreement, then it must not be clear. So we want to make sure it's clear.
Yeah, what it boils down to, I think there may be just four or five items, and each item is like one paragraph. So we're not talking about a book. Thank you.
Hey, Marilyn.
Hi, Kurt. My name is Marilyn Cade, and I'm speaking as an individual business owner. I have three questions. I may be back to the microphone later in my elected capacity, but that's not what I'm speaking in now. The first one is easy, I think. It's a clarification. Yesterday, I was fortunate to sit in a briefing that you did for the GNSO, that is the generic name supporting organization, in which you answered questions, and I perhaps misheard. So I thought yesterday you were asked, have the evaluators been retained and are they ready to go? I thought the answer was no, but I thought you said yes, the answer was yes. So 24 hours is a long time, but maybe not that long a time.
You want me to answer? So one by one, we've selected evaluators but not contracted with them yet. I thought that was the answer I gave. So we're in contract negotiations.
Okay. So my second question is, this confuses me. So,
Ross in general? Sorry.
This PowerPoint confuses me. And I think it's important for us to, as a community, have a good understanding. So, I read at Economic Study Phase 2 that was delivered on Friday that presents new information. And I understand that the board is receiving moment-by-moment updates. No doubt they can't be in the room all the time because they're busy studying those moment-by-moment updates that the staff are having to do. However, I'm confused by this because if there is new information presented, I'm familiar with the ICANN bylaws. If there is new information presented, I think we have to assess how we're going to be able to take that new information into account and then make any adjustments that are necessary. I would make one other comment, and that is I'm very familiar with product and service introductions, having done a number. I know what alphas are, I know what betas are, I know what CIs are. I know what CI 1, 2, and 3 is, and I know what a final product is. While I'm okay with our doing a CI, because that ought to be cooked enough that it's stable, I really think we've got to make sure we're not doing alphas and betas. My third point is that I think it's going to, I'm really going to go back to this point. If we're sitting here giving information and doing our work and assessing what is being presented to us and coming to the microphone and saying, here's new information and here's what we're concerned about and we think our concerns are valid, how do we figure out at what point that's a waste of our voice and our time, and we just need to pack up and withdraw?
So I'm gonna start with the last question first, because I think the process has been very, very responsive to those who bring questions and issues. So not all requested changes have been made, and there's contention with the community on just about every issue. as you and I both painfully know. But the guidebook has a lot of red, and it's done with. And the staff really don't have a dog in the fight, except to launch a process that we think is going to be stable, predictable, and all those things. So we're continuing to look for accommodation. I think that, I've sat with the board now, much more than they wanted me to over the last month. At three face-to-face meetings, two face-to-face meetings and a teleconference in a month to talk about new GPLDs. And they are... sensitive and listening to the public. So I sit in there and I think every comment like this is heard. And if the board detects that we need some way to make time to, that we've looked at the economic study, it looks like we need to listen to the community on this, I think people saying that will have effect. But the board will listen to everybody. So I have a lot more confidence and faith in that. You think I'd be jaded now, but heck no, I'm not.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Brett.
Hi. I'm Brett Fawcett, and I'm thinking about the next steps from the point of view of a new TLD applicant. And both in 2000 and 2004, ICANN provided a very helpful fact period that followed the publication of the application guidelines and the opening of the application window. I wanted to ask whether ICANN was planning to do that again, and if not, I would highly encourage ICANN to do that. This was the process whereby people could say, I have a question about number 34. What did you mean about, and you can ask a question. It's published anonymously,
yep.
And then ICANN provides an answer that the entire community can see. And I think both in 2000 and 2004, there were dozens of questions like that that were very helpful to applicants.
Yep. Thank you. Hi, I'm Amadeo.
Hello. You're getting the usual people in quite the usual order. Yeah, it seems like we were rehearsing that for many years now. This is Amadeo Abril from CORE. I am asking for three very short clarifications, one short request, one short comment. Let's start with the clarifications. In the draft agreement, there is some special clauses for international organizations and governments or governmental organizations. Now, my question is whether this is read in non-Anglo-Saxon worlds as public authorities. That is, it comprises both the central governments of sovereign states, nations, countries, wherever, or it also includes things like the Commonwealth of Virginia or the City of New York, that is, local authorities, regional authorities, and state authorities. Because they have exactly the same problems regarding jurisdiction, mandatory arbitration, and things like that. Second quick clarification. It specifically says in the final draft proposed something that the same entity can act as registry and registrar, but this is always under the level cross-ownership, which seems to imply different entities. I have seen some people being confused about that, so perhaps it should be clarified whether it's cross-ownership, meaning between different entities, or it's simply the question of integrated services, and just changing the heading could help. The third clarification is regarding the question of uniqueness of names in the community evaluation. Because this is, there are some clarifications regarding non-uniqueness of a geographic name in the same geography. But there's not much clarification about doesn't mean that it's not unique globally. For instance, .cat, there's apparently an animal in English that uses that name that everybody else knows that refers to my language and culture. .gal, they thought they had no problem, but apparently in some slang English, it means girl or something like that. And then, we're checking with .eus, Euskadi, Euskal Language and Culture. They were sure there was nothing in an English dictionary, but there is. Eus is the usual abbreviation for esophageal ultrasonography. But it hurts when you're reading
really.
So some more clarification. Com means rice in Vietnamese. Knet means either grandson or clean in Catalan, depending whether you have an open or an closed E. So some clarification on what does it mean, conflict of a name for a community regarding the global, if that's only English or any language in the world, would be helpful. I'm not against the idea, simply that's not clear to me when I read the guidelines. And finally, the request and the comment. The request is, course experience is that when We've been dealing with internal evaluators. Internal doesn't mean internal to ICANN staff. It means internal to the DNS community. Things has been pretty smooth. When dealing with external, completely external evaluators like in .NET or, you know, in 2000, very often there was misunderstanding in the questions and the answers. So please provide a system where there is a resort to somebody inside the DNS community and the staff to, you know, somehow mediate when some people don't understand the questions. I have a comment. It was regarding community evaluation, but probably this goes better in the written comments than here.
Okay. Thank you, Amadeo. Can Amy or Dan, can you help me with regard to the international governments, you know, the type of form of agreement, you know, whether it would apply to, governments or, like, state governments? All right. Well, we'll try to clarify that. And the comment about integrated services and cross-ownership is a very good one. The important distinction I want to make is that a cross-owned or integrated registry registrar still needs to get a registrar accreditation in order to perform registrar services. Well, you know, I can't really always understand. And your other comment about, so your comment about clarifying about the uniqueness is well taken. Oh, this way. Hey.
Hi, Kurt. Jonathan Zook from ACT. I was excited when you got to your slides about measuring success, but as you read them, they seemed like they were still fairly abstract concepts and not really measures. And I'm wondering if any of that's going to kind of get reduced to some measurable things and maybe some objectives and goals for those measures that might be produced prior to the launch of the program so that there actually is some way to determine whether or not those objectives were met.
Yeah, so we have some candidate objective measures. The board, Bruce, if he's still there, specifically requested a board session where staff can present to the board what we think the measures of success are and get board feedback on that. And we'll be also sharing that with the community, you know, specific measures.
When's that meeting happening? I mean,
It's just a private, you know, it's just a board workshop update as part of that. So I just was trying to let you know the board's very interested in the exact same thing you are about specificity of measures. Okay. So we all want to stand up at the end of the day and say we won. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. Name's Mike Palage. Just a disclosure statement here. Over the last 11 years, this is my 35th ICANN meeting, and over the last 11 years, I have contracted with over half of the new GTLD applicants that ICANN have approved for entry into the route. I'm working with a number of applicants as well, waiting for the process to be finalized. So I have an interest in ICANN beginning the closure of this process responsibly. Three points I'd like to make. Number one, I'd like to highlight the importance of the work Avra Doria and that working group is doing. And to highlight the importance of the work they're doing, I'd like to refer back to a statement you had made earlier about the importance of eliminating poverty as one of the panoply of things that we'd be solving with new GTLDs. And you referred to the comments from the Colombian official during the welcoming ceremony. So my question to you is, how long would it take for the average Colombian family, if they didn't eat, pay medical expenses or anything, how long would it take for them to save up and apply for a new GTLD at the current rate?
I don't know. I know it would take me a long time. Your point's well taken.
14 years. Moving on to point two. I don't know. I'll leave that to the other wonderful panoply of issues that these new GTLDs will solve. Getting to point two, okay? And it deals, again, with economics here. Approximately 2 years ago, I engaged with negotiations with ICANN staff and the renegotiation of the .coop contract. And at that time, one of the terms that we agreed to was for the registration of 50,000 names for $5,000 a year. That was the registry fee. Now, in a new template agreement, for those same 50,000 names, it's now $25,000. So that's a 500% increase in 2 years. And now this is not part of the cost recovery, the $186,000. This is part of the ongoing operation. So I was wondering, and I've asked for an explanation in numerous forums, even in last year's budget. So perhaps as part of the affirmation commitments, which talks about explaining its decisions, you could explain this 500% increase, because one of the things I was hearing about how new GTLs, what new GTLDs are going to bring is cost savings, innovation, 500% increase on ICANN's base fees. I'm having a little hard time sort of reconciling that. And I just forgot what the third point is. If I remember it, I'll come back.
Well, talk for a while if you want. So, it's a 500% increase on the existing co-op fee, but not 500% on other registry agreements. And I'll share.
All the STLDs, that's the same fee that you put in Museum, the same that you put in Arrow.
Yes, but the transaction, with the transaction fees, it's different. We were trying to establish a fairly low baseline. But I will share with you, what are the other things we're going to hear in here? We're going to hear about increased compliance costs and, monitoring registry compliance with new trademark protections and other new registry obligations. And think about, $25,000 of a fully burdened, employee is, a sixth of an employee or something like that. So then take the employee across registry liaison, compliance, IANA, a little bit of finance, a little bit of me, and, parse that. We want to provide services to the community and services to the registry in a competent way. And so to us, we continue to hone numbers, but to us, the $25,000 fee is a little scary. We talk about some of the initiatives we want to take as ICANN in service to the community are quite expensive. And so, $25,000 can be framed up by you as a lot in the world of .coop, with whom we seek to make accommodations because we know they're a small registry. But for us, in trying to accomplish our mission and thinking about a world of a few hundred registries, can be daunting. So, we can sit over cocktails and scribble numbers on napkins.
Instead of scribbling on napkins, what I'd like to do is I'd like to raise a point that I raised each of the 3 years that I served on the board.
So I'm for publishing that information.
Exactly. And just to go back, when I was on the board and served on the board finance committee, since ICANN is supposed to act in a cost recovery manner, one of the things I asked for but never got was the implementation of timesheets. And using co-op as an example, the number of UDRP disputes that they have had in about 8 years or 9 years of operation, zero. So if ICANN is going to operate on a cost recovery mechanism, it would be helpful to see what staff resources are going to be allocated, because perhaps there are some small registries that may involve actually more than $25,000 of ICANN time and effort. So if we do that, that's probably a responsible way to serve all applicants. And I now just remember what my third point was, and it actually goes to a point that Amadeo raised yesterday. As part of what you think you now have as a final product that you've now test-stressed it through different things. And the point goes to what Amadeo says, that if .cat was to come forward today and apply in this application, it's very doubtful that they would have made it through the process. And I think that's an important check that the board needs to ask itself, because when you look at the 2004 round, they're kind of a success. They have 40,000 names, I don't know of any trademark disputes. They are serving a distinct one trademark dispute. They're serving a distinct community, and more importantly, from a branding standpoint, I think they have the highest number of index pages in Google's. So again, your economic report that talks about past successes predicting future events, I would suggest you scale your current process against .cat. Thank you.
So, Steve, I just want to point out that .coop has zero UDRPs and .cat only has one. So where are the trademark problems? It was a joke, Marilyn. So, in serious answer to Michael's question, The process is meant to test names against with a nexus against the community. So Amadeo pointed out earlier that in his neck of the woods, .cat means Catalan. You know, in other areas of the world, a cat means something completely different. So that gets, you know, a pretty high score. You know, if he applied for .catalan in this environment, he'd get a very, very high score. So it's meant to encourage nexus between the names in the community. But I do want to refer to the success of the .cat registry. Mr. Foodie.
Hello, Kurt. Paul Foodie. Kurt, in view of the comment by Harold Elverstrand in Brussels that he thought the single component domain name would be TLD would be a very bad idea, I'm really surprised that there doesn't seem to be anything in this latest applicant guidebook that would prevent the million name route.
So a single component domain name, do you mean a single letter domain name?
Yeah, the root of a million TLDs is what Harold was talking about back in Brussels. There doesn't seem to be anything in the applicant guidebook that's going to prevent that.
Right, so the process is not limited in that way, but the process is limited in the delegation rates. And it's limited by the world economy and
so you say it's limited in the delegation rate. You're referring, is that the a maximum of 1,000 a year? How long are you going to maintain that for? Is that going to last for a year, 2 years?
Well, so we're going to go through a round of applications and process them. And
so it doesn't really restrict anything, does it? I mean, if you're saying this time it's 1,000, but next time it could be unlimited. You know, it really doesn't answer anything. So, in view of the amount of red line in this in your latest latest applicant guidebook, quite honestly, I think you should just chuck the thing away and start again. And you know, you're talking about 1,000 GTLDs. You know, as a suggestion, why not go to the world's biggest 1,000 cities? Say, right, you each get your own TLD. You can have it in your IDN, and we're going to do a we're going to do a test run and see how this goes. Because the way it is at the moment, it's really ill-conceived.
All right. Thanks for your comment, Mr.
Thank you.
Hello, young fellow.
Ron Andruff, RNA Partners, and a member of the business constituency, speaking on my own behalf, and also a potential applicant. Kurt, I was very happy to see that in your success measurements, you noted market differentiation as one of the things that will be measured. We in the BC and many other constituencies have had concern about market differentiation and that we don't create a cloned space going forward. And the idea of this whole round in many people's eyes was to get away from the idea of multiple or duplicative registrations. So my first question, if you could just kindly give us some definition of what market differentiation means in your view, if we're going to measure against it, what does that mean? And the second question is a little more simple, has to do with compliance. As you mentioned, three people need to be filled, the head of compliance and two junior staff. And the concern is that we have not had a head of compliance now for about 4 or 5 months, and we're about to embark on this process. Now the board has taken the decision that vertical integration is allowed, and we will handle that through compliance, but we don't seem to have anybody on the horizon to be able to manage that. And when we look back historically, compliance has been the biggest bugaboo we've had within ICANN, and now we're about to expand by the orders of magnitude of 10 and 20. I'm concerned that we really need to get those individuals in place. So could you please shed some light on that for the community?
Yeah, so I appreciate the last comment, and was anticipating it with my digression during the presentation. The compliance department's performing really well. It's going to be staffed, and I understand the community concerns. I know how hard people are working to meet those goals. So personally, of the things I lose sleep over, I think the people operating the contractual compliance department are gonna be very successful. And I just also want to describe briefly that a regulated environment really requires more compliance activities than an unregulated environment. If we have separations put in place, ICANN compliance staff would be performing functions that are really not value added to the DNS, you know, making sure that, you know, you don't have an agreement somewhere with you. I need to know, you know, with whom you have agreements, where your staff works, or how long your, you know, what your staff lists are. So actually, I think the departure from a regulated environment will actually help ICANN concentrate compliance activities where they have real value added, and that is contributing toward user and registrant protection and DNS stability. So I think the move to that environment is helpful. And then, market differentiation is going to be difficult to measure. I don't know if it can be set up a priori. That's something we would certainly talk to economists about. They've had trouble predicting it, but maybe they can know it when they see it. So I don't think specific measurements can be set up a priori, just like categories of TLDs are really difficult to set up a priori until the marketplace develops and we see where entrepreneurs want to take their TLD.
Well, one simple measure is to ask, how do you differentiate from anything else that's in the DNS? Now, that could be a very clear statement. We differentiate because. And I think any person that would look at that with common sense would be able to start making some steps in that direction. But we really need to have that. We cannot go forward and just say it's now time to have an open competition. There's one shared route in the world. And that route we need to make sure, because we're the stewards of this process, that in fact we are making differentiation. When I go into a shop and I want to buy a bag of potato chips, I expect there'll be multiple brands there that will offer me all kinds of different things, and I make my selection. The internet is not like that. We have one. And so we need to make sure very clearly that market differentiation is there and that we do not have a clone space, because that is not competition. That is catastrophe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, this is Constantine from the Dell Music Initiative. I have a question on the term community. Is there any way to get a full score of 16 for a proper noun, for a non-proper noun? So this is the GTLD program. It's called Generic Top-Level Domains. But when you talk about brands or cities or regions, they're not really nouns. They're not really generic.
Yeah.
So there's a component in the guidebook that says community. So for the last 2.5 years, we've been out there for the music community getting support, talking to a lot of trade organizations. And it seems that even with a industry-led coalition, there's no way that you can get a score of 14. And the other thing is, people that are out there public with their plans, creating support, under the support opposition, it says relevant opposition from two or more groups of non-negligible size, you lose 2 points. So let's say I bring in 20 trade organizations and there's two big ones that are against it. Does that mean I get 14 points? That's my first thing. So there's a trade-off to being public and gathering a lot of support. And my other question is, why isn't there any points on the differentiation of the top-level domain? What differentiates me with another applicant? I think that's really important and should be taken into consideration. And if community outreach is important, transparency, openness, I think that should also be part of the support. Because the way that I'm seeing it, we'll get 2 points for support, lose 2 points because two out of the 20 are opposing to what we're doing, because there's always opposition. You can't please 100% of everyone. So it just seems that even with an industry coalition on board, there's going to be some significant support because some people just don't want them to be successful. So how do we deal with these things? So I'm hoping that the community part of the application would be more, can a generic get 16 points? That's my basic question. How do we help bring differentiation and innovation and have a community point system that reflects that? Thank you.
So when you said 16 points at the end, you really meant 14, right?
Well, it says you can only get community if you get 14 out of 16.
Right.
And I'm saying I'm starting at 14 because I'm for sure I'm going to get two points for opposition lost.
So anyway, your comments are really well thought out. You need to really write them down and send them in. And so
can I get a? Whenever I write something, I never get any responses back. Is there any way that I could get a response on it?
Yeah. So read the comment summaries and write them in the detail that you just described.
I shall do that. Thank you.
Hey.
Hi, Kurt. Elaine Pruis. Thank you for the work you've done to get the program to this point. And I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the opening ceremony this morning.
Me too.
And one thing I heard in the opening ceremony was Rod Beckstrom say that opening up the namespace to new generic top-level domains is intended to promote competition, innovation, and consumer choice. Yet I'm hearing in the halls and even at the microphone some rumblings that despite several economic reports over the last many years, claims that ICANN still hasn't proven that adding more TLDs to the root would be beneficial to society. And that has to be done before we can open the application window. So I think it's important to us to hear the list of studies that have been completed at a cost of, you said yesterday, roughly $1 to $2 million to the ICANN community. Report from Cray International, Revisiting Vertical Separation of Registries and Registrars, October 2008. Mm-hmm. Preliminary analysis of Dennis Carlton regarding price caps for new GTLD internet registries, March 2009. Preliminary report of Dennis Carlton regarding impact of new GTLDs on consumer welfare, March 2009. Comments on Michael Kendi's assessment of preliminary reports on competition and pricing, June 2009. Report of Dennis Carlton regarding ICANN's proposed mechanism for introducing new GTLDs, June 2009. An economic framework for the analysis of the expansion of generic top-level domain names, June 2010. And Friday, economic considerations in the expansion of generic top-level domains, Phase 2, December 2010. So that's the list of the reports that have been done. Also in the opening ceremony this morning, I heard Columbia's Minister of Technology provide a detailed presentation of his efforts to bring innovation and jobs to Columbia through the internet. The Colombian government is committing $2.8 billion to that effort, and despite the fact that numerous surveys conducted have shown the majority of Colombian citizens see no personal need to have the internet, they're proceeding with that. He said, if we make it available and build applications that are appealing, there will be more users, more demand, and therefore growth. I'm suggesting that if the groundwork and infrastructure is in place, innovation can occur and applications appealing to consumers can be built. He also said the opportunity to create innovation on the internet will reduce poverty, create jobs, and increase competition and safety. Here at ICANN meetings, we are supposed to develop policies that's based on consensus positions. Yet, for the last 2 years, we've heard several self-protectionist opponents demand study after study that proves the consumer need for innovation. And in response, we've seen some blog posts that give analogies to this expression. Did the Wright brothers do market studies to get a solid number on the demand to fly from consumers? And on that line, Mr. Pelage asked, how long will it take for a Colombian family to save up for a new TLD when really all they want to do, they don't want to save up for an airplane, they just want to fly on it. So I think that analogy is a little obscure. But what about the bicycle? How about the iPhone? Have there been studies that have proven the benefit to society based on that innovation? I don't think so. So I think it's time to put the demand to prove the unpredictable to rest and allow innovation and progress to flourish. So my question is, are you planning any more studies?
So that sounds like an erudite version of a coffee break at ICANN. So thank you very much for your comment. I think there are more economic studies because we want to at least measure the success of the project. So we want to see what we've accomplished and change the process so we can continue to improve both in the areas of bringing benefits and more importantly to make sure that the trademark protections and other protections we put in place can be made more effective. But anyway, great. If you could send that to me, it'd be great.
Okay, so that's a measure of success, which implies that there'll be some product out there to be tested. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Kurt. Steve Metallitz speaking on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability, group of eight leading organizations and companies in the music, movie, and software space. I have two brief comments and one question. First, it's interesting there's still a lot of questions and issues about the community objection process and the community evaluation process. These are points that you identified as 99% complete about 6 months ago, but apparently you're hearing from the community that maybe they're not quite that complete. I want to associate myself with Amadeo's third clarification point. The COA has made this point at least twice, and you've rejected it twice, so I think we know what the answer will be when Amadeo sends it in again, but we still agree that uniqueness should be based on the language relevant to the community and not any language in the world. Second, I appreciate your slide on what information will be made public. That was helpful to have that. As ICANN increasingly outsources, it seems to me, the responsibility for ensuring that for minimizing the risks of negative impacts from new GTLDs to the public, and relies says this is not our job, or we've gone as far as we need to go in doing this, for example, with malicious conduct. The role of public comment becomes even more important. So it is essential to make sure that the public will actually have the information that they need to make intelligent comments on new GTLD applications as they come in so that those can be considered by the evaluators. My question actually was triggered by something Avery said, which is that in the registry, the vertical separation issue, vertical integration issue, isn't just about ownership and cross-ownership. There's also questions like, why is it always necessary for registrations in the new GTLD to be handled by registrars? Aren't there circumstances in which the registry should be able to do that directly? Similarly, aren't there situations in which it shouldn't be necessary to ban a certain type of TLD registry from entering into an exclusive arrangement with one or more accredited registrars rather than making it open to every registrar? This obviously wouldn't necessarily be the case in all circumstances, but there certainly could be circumstances, and in our prior comments we've elucidated some of those. So my question is, in the vertical integration decision, what consideration was given to any relaxation of the requirements that registries not be allowed to conduct registration directly and that registries be barred from exclusive arrangements with accredited registrars?
You know what? Can you read the last two sentences of your question again? So when considering the vertical integration?
Yes. In considering that, was any consideration given to either of the following? One, relaxing the requirement that registries always act through registrars in making registrations in their TLD. And second, the ban, on registries entering into any exclusive arrangements with registrars to accomplish registration. Was any consideration given to that?
Yeah, so I think the answer to the first one's no. And so, but I understand it's a very valid point. I understand the, different business models going forward that wouldn't affect DNS stability or users or anything like that. So I think that's a discussion that needs to evolve. I think it'll take a longer time. The latter question, though, I think that was anticipated. There is a perception that might be right or wrong that, like a company owning a TLD self-registering names can register them with whoever registrar they want, so they can pick one and register all names there. I understand a scenario where they'd want their users, their registrants registering with that registrar too. I'm not so sure there's not a way to accomplish that in the existing regime with discounts or agreements similar to ones that exist today.
So you think a registry can pick one registrar and say we will channel all the registrations through that?
It certainly can channel all their own registrations. It can certainly, enter into some, their registrars and registries have agreements now where volume discounts are offered, so it can make it attractive for that, your registrants to use that registrar. I think, you know, what the I guess the rub is, you know, barring other registrars from considering that. So we'd have to have it, you know, that would have to be developed.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bob Hutchinson from Dynamic Ventures. I have two comments or questions that I'd like a little clarification on. One is the area of security and stability in the applicants, in the application. I'm not a believer in security by obscurity. I believe that their plans should be published and available to the public. Is that going to be considered? Apparently not, according to your current slide. And so I'll let you comment on that. I have one other comment.
Yeah, so so that's a balancing, right? When we talked about it, you know, we came to the opposite conclusion. But, you know, here's a meeting with the where the ESAC is, you know, meeting, and we would certainly take their advice if they had an opinion on that. And there's other portions of the ICANN technical community that if they were to offer an opinion on that, we'd certainly take that. So, you know, I'm certainly not the best person or, you know, administrative people, not the best people to make that call. You know, it makes sense to me to keep it secret. It makes sense to publish it so the security plans can be publicly vetted. So I would talk to the members of the ICANN, you know, the ESAC and the technical community and have that
the
discussion.
The part of security
there
that needs to be kept contained is incident response, okay? And I don't think anybody's objecting to that. But new registries need to have solid security and stability plans, and I think that they need to be vetted by the public. That's my opinion. The second question that I have is...
So your job is not done then. You need to talk to, like...
I heard your comment. Thank you. The second part is, could you give us a brief summary of where you believe IPv6 support for new registries is? Is that a requirement for all of throughout their operations and their registrant data, or just the registrant data, or where is it?
I don't know. There's a requirement for IPv6 deployment by the registries, and I can't answer that, you know, as far as the detail, but I will go over there and make a note about it and go find out and answer your question.
Okay.
You're recommending the full...
I absolutely think that we are... Well, we're talking about running out Christmas time.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas. No more IP addresses. It seems foolish to allow new registries to begin operation without a full IPv6 plan.
Okay. Full? Okay, thank you.
Hi, Kurt. Anthony Vancouvering from Minds and Machines. I'd like to make a few comments about the economic study. We're in the middle of what I hope is our lifetime's gravest economic crisis. And economists today are having a hard time figuring out what happened, and very few of them are daring to predict what will happen next. They have hopes, but that's all they have. And I understand why ICANN is performing an economic study. It's because it has agreed to do so under the affirmations of commitment, and I fully support them standing up to their commitments. I hope they will do that when we start registries and we rely on ICANN as well. But the value of predictive economic studies, I think, is at best very doubtful. And in this current one, I'd like to point to a fundamental flaw that sort of shoots through it, which is that the authors seem to assume, against all of the statements of potential applicants and many other people, that a Latin-based, unrestricted, generic TLD, one is the same as another. And they compare between them and say, why is it that if mospizza.com is taken in New York, why isn't mospizza.biz registered in San Francisco? Let me assure you that all TLDs are not the same. And to say that no competition will be given to .com because a new TLD is Latin-based and unrestricted is completely unwarranted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Steve
Delbianco with NetChoice. Two very brief questions. In Module 1, the guidebook includes a very important but relatively limited detail on the notion of batching and, quote, recognizing capacity limitations due to managing extended evaluation, string contention, et cetera, quote, go on to set a batch. And I think I was there in Korea last year, about a year ago, when you said, based on your calculations, you thought 500 was the batch size. Well, in the years since Korea, there have been a lot of changes, so many changes that your red line scroll made the screen look pink. But a lot of changes and a lot more emphasis on the objection and public comment process to try to vet and stop and correct applications rather than build all of it in prescriptively. Recognizing all that and knowing that you will be measured by the effectiveness of the evaluation process, do you really still think 500 is a doable batch for application processing?
Yeah, so I think so. The critical path or the tall pole in that are the technical evaluations of the applications. And, you know, our models say that we'll need 75 evaluators to process 500 applications in the 4.5 months promised. And that remains the same. It gives me a platform to comment that all the red lines and all our public discussion is about objection and dispute resolution process, community TLDs, trademark protections, which are very important, but not about the evaluation process and the questions and the criteria. And we come to each meeting, and nobody, says you got to make these questions more clear. You know, we think they're good. We go back every interim. You know, we mark them up ourselves. We consult with experts. But that portion of the guidebook, while redlined by staff in consultation with experts, has not really been discussed much by the community yet. It is the place in the guidebook where every single applicant will pass and be evaluated. So so not much has changed with regard.
So you don't believe, you believe you could handle the extended objection contention process for 500 simultaneous applications?
Yeah, so there's not, so every... every application goes through evaluation, technical, financial, some other stuff, right, string evaluation, and then, which is sort of going to be routinized, and then there's an objection process. And so we've assigned, you know, they're definitely wrong, but we've assigned percentages of how many applications are going to go where, and we have sort of a pachinko machine to model that. And so, like I said, the critical path is in this part up here where we're going through this routinized application. Okay. The objection processes are kind of like on their own time.
Okay. Well, second question, yep. Brief question. You said this morning that the effectiveness of safeguards per the AOC was so important, but a lot of that won't be known until post-delegation. So when you said it was speculative, we won't know until that. Doesn't that argue for a similar batching concept or even a trial period of the first set of delegations to evaluate whether effective safeguards are really there for security, stability, and rights protection, instead of just delegating based on the technical capacity of the route to accept new records? You've indicated that there's another real concern about whether we'll meet the effectiveness of safeguards test, and that argues for batching as well.
Well, there already is an internet, right? There already is practices of TLDs. So you're making an excellent point. I'll make another one. So what do? We want to try and make this version of the DNS safer, more stable for trademark holders, business owners, users, registrant, the whole lot, and try to maximize benefit. So when the community raised these issues about trademark protection or malicious conduct, you know, we got the people that know what they're talking about in the room, you know, the IRT and people from the Anti-Phishing Working Group and FIRST and CERT. RISG, and said, okay, develop a set of protections that we can implement. So we think that we've taken we can brag about ourselves. We've taken some of the best minds in the world on these issues, right, and crafted a set of solutions that aren't to the satisfaction of all, but certainly a big change from where they were.
Totally different point, though. However good or bad they are, the point is once they're launched, you admitted yourself, it's speculative as to how effective they'll be. The clearinghouse is new. And the Sunrise processes that we have and the TM claims, these are new processes. And we won't really know how well they're working, in your own words, until they're up and running for a while. And to do that simultaneously with hundreds of apps while new ones are piling into the root every month, it strikes me as maybe taking more risks than you need to take.
Yeah, well, we think we're launching in a stable way, but I take your point.
Hi, Kurt. Mike Pelage again. I just wanted to follow up on a point that Steve Metallitz had raised about the use of registrars and certain brand TLDs. And what I'd like to do is, if you go back to the original economic report, the CRAE, they mentioned the inefficiencies of using registrars with Big Co. Why would a company have to go to a third party to register names mm-hmm. with itself? Again, they use the word inefficiencies in that model. During the Seoul presentation, Comiskey, in the panel discussion, talked about registrars adding another element in the registration process and how that represented a potential security threat. And the reason I'm raising these points is I think you've heard in the GAC, as part of the affirmation of commitments, the need for ICANN to explain itself. And what would be very helpful here is, in the vertical integration, I applaud the board for the choice they did. In large part, they adopted the proposals of CAM, which mm-hmm. I co-authored with Milton and Avery Doria. So I'm happy with this solution, but what I'd like to do is have an explanation on what they considered and didn't consider, because here there are your first economist said there is not a need for registrars, but they decided not to adopt that. And this is why it's so important to have this explanation. And the reason why is there's the potential for some to be cynical that ICANN only is imposing the use of registrars because it then gets to double dip in the fee collection, 18 cents from the register. Well, but see, Wahoo is not, but that's not the right answer.
Well, of course it's not, and so look at me, right? What look at those guys over there. They're all concerned with stability and security, being able to enforce agreements. So two things. One is, yes, the board described a lot of the basis of its decision in the whereas, but I know they've discussed with the publication of the detailed board report on that meeting more information about how that decision was derived. So that's one. I know that one of the discussions that took place in the staff evaluation of this is that if we agree to not have registrars for certain registries, that sets into place a very, very complex compliance environment where you have to monitor a registry to make sure it's, you know, a brand TLD. You know, who are its employees? Give us your employee lists or your agents lists. You know, how do you monitor that? It's all very expensive work that's not value-added. So that, well, I don't disagree with your assertion that, and Steve Metallitz's assertion that for certain TLDs, registrars are sort of superfluous. I think a policy discussion needs to occur to identify those cases where registrars are not required, because it is a complex and potentially expensive undertaking. And I don't think that's a staff call for developing criteria just based on public comment for canceling that need in certain cases.
Well, actually, it's a board call, and they made a board call on the initial vertical integration, so I don't see why they couldn't make it here. And, you know, not to belabor that point, but this, I think your suggestion here about, well, it's complex, we need to see how things evolve, actually ties in brilliantly to the point Steve Del Bianco made. Can you necessarily respond with 500 at the same time? Smaller batches may be the way to go.
Amadeo, did I say something wrong a little while ago?
No. The only thing is that you missed to say the exact date in which we can send the applications in. So that was my question. No. Now, seriously, for one thing, I might grow older, but I could not hear and understand your answer regarding what government entity means in the draft agreement, Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And sorry, but this is important for many of our customers who are cities. And I can tell you that, for instance, the City Hall of Paris or Barcelona, they cannot submit to mandatory arbitration. It's not that they don't like, they are not allowed to. Or, for instance, they cannot sign insurance policies forbidden by the law in most European countries for public authorities. They are responsible. They cannot even insure themselves against that. But they have enough funds, more than most applicants you will see, to cover that. Now, the problem is if they are not allowed to have these exceptions, they need to create a new entity because you will not accept entities' information, which is perfectly okay, but it's new. Now, they cannot form a new entity for a resource that does not exist legally, has not been given to them, and fund that. So they will fail the financial evaluation if they need to form a completely empty new entity, and they cannot apply as themselves. So just clarify that in either sense, so we will know what to do and what to speed. Second clarification, I said there was one trademark case, but not one UDP case for .cat. There were two others, but one of them, none of the parties had a trademark. They just wanted to fight because they've been doing that for the last 30 years to rival associations of engineers. And the third one was a case in which, in fact, it was not a a UDP case, because it was a terminated car dealer using the signs, but he had a contract showing he had the right to use those signs. Simply, it was terminated. The registry could not know at the time of registration. Now, for the important thing, on the discussion of whether .cat would pass or fail, it's not important whether .cat would pass or fail because it's already there. The question here is, it's not because of the name being unique or not. The question is that when we go to the policies, you say, well, eligibility at some points, that is, who can register, whether you check whether they belong to the community or not. Absolutely fair. We support that. On the other end, enforcement, serious enforcement, credible enforcement, points or lack of points, absolutely logical. In the middle, when you regard the registration policies, eligibility and content and use are two different things, when in reality it's one or the other. You have eligibility, that and name selection, sorry, not eligibility, name selection, that is, you say only people from the community may apply, and they can only use their own name, for instance, so they cannot use any name for which they don't have a concrete and prior right to. You don't need any use control. Because, you know, what could happen there if, I don't know, the Guggenheim Museum only can use Guggenheim? It could be harmful for the community if they are allowed to use art.museum, correct? Because, you know, art is larger than Guggenheim. But if they use Guggenheim, neither .museum nor anybody else should tell them, what do you do with your own name? You're eligible. You are using only your name. So content and use is usually a replacement.
Could you ask Amadeo to slow down? Please, the scribes and the interpreters are just going into meltdown.
Oh, they are not the usual scribes? They should not be. Sorry. Okay, I'm getting excited when I talk about, you know, policies for name registration, you see. Sorry about that. No, the question is that in practical terms, Kurt and all the staff, these two things in reality are, you use one or the other to achieve the same goal of having a very low level of possible conflicts outside the community and even inside the community. If you do name selection, you don't do content and use checks. If you do content and use checks, it's because name selection is impractical for many reasons, or because you had to change that, like .com at a certain point, right? So please don't make this one and the other. It's one or the other. Here, people are losing one point plus another point on, you know, the question of predetermined communities. For the question of opposition, I don't agree with Constantinos. Sorry, if there is opposition, there is opposition, and all communities should deal with that. But this name selection or plus use is absolutely artificial.
Thank you, Amadeo. Dan, did you have an answer for Amadeo's first question?
Yes, thank you, Kurt, and thank you, Amadeo, for your comments. This is Dan Halloran from ICANN staff. There were a lot of good questions and comments there, and please, Amadeo, I think the scribes are having trouble keeping up, and we'll have trouble going back. And so please, written comments are most helpful, especially on the one that you asked twice, the question about who can get the modified base agreement. So we have the base agreement, which is supposed to be in substantial form for all applicants, but we've noted in the base agreement where we could have different provisions that would only apply for governmental entities. And we meant that, governmental entities, but, I mean, as you pointed out, and as we're just beginning to understand, we can guess That's a complicated question. What exactly is a governmental entity? It could vary. There are public-private partnerships or quasi-governmental or city associations. So we'd like any comments you can give on that, and especially if you can help with guidelines, parameters, criteria for helping us decide when that should apply and when should not. We'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. So two more comments, and then I think we're over. So,
thanks, Kurt. Andrew Mack. We've heard an awful lot about the cost of this new round, and that's going to be potentially a real barrier for a lot of people who are either in an emerging markets context where there's not a lot of resource, a community context, or people who want to serve them, right? We talked also about the complexity of this round, the 500 potential applications, and all the effort that's going to put, and the strain that's going to put on ICANN staff. And so one of the things that we talked about in our working group was this idea of bundling, that you might be able to offer effectively put in a group of applications using different IDN scripts so as to get more IDNs in the root, get more people, less the digital divide, that kind of thing. When we were talking in Brussels, you seemed pretty warm to that idea. Makes sense? And how can we move that forward?
So, you'll have to describe bundling a little bit more.
The idea is this, basically, is that if we want to serve, if you want to get your new GDLT out into multiple scripts, right? Mm-hmm. Smaller scripts especially wouldn't be able to be built out if you are charging a whole 185, right? But if you say, we'll go and we'll buy the six-pack, not just the individual beer, you get a bit of a discount, you support communities that need that support, that kind of thing. So that's the idea behind bundling. And, you seemed warm to it in Brussels. I wanted to just get some feedback, you know?
Warm beer.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think what I said in Brussels that I think I said the opposite, but I think I said that the cost for the new TLD program will smack right up against the fee we're charging as far as a cost basis, and we think the cost average of all the applications will rise to absorb that. So bundling and volume discounts, is that?
Well, the challenge is this, okay? When you're looking, we're already in a situation of digital divide, right?
Yeah.
Where there are already haves and have-nots in this community. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that if you make it such that Amharic or Arabic or some of the smaller languages, Arabic not being a smaller language, but some of the smaller languages really can't get on the web because they can't afford this. This 185 is going to be way too high for them to get over. Then what you're effectively doing is saying to them, lose your language, right? Lose your script at least, or you're off the web. And so the idea behind bundling was basically a way to get them in. These are things that wouldn't otherwise happen, right? And a way of addressing the needs of underserved communities and underserved language groups.
So I got your point exactly, and I understand the need. And Avery, so this is the...
this is one of the things...
Don't stand up, and don't shake your head. But we're trying to parse between those with need and maybe very well-to-do entities that are looking for volume discounts that are already very well-to-do, and I wonder if there's a way to parse between that when you're making criteria for who has need. So, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Werner.
My name is Werner Staub. I speak in a personal capacity. First, I would like to commend the board for having finally come out with a timeline. It is not maybe the best timeline that we could imagine, but at least there is one. And I'm really concerned that we're losing it again. This has been going on for 6 years. The last timeline that board was set, that was importantly as an announcement, was in 2003 for the process to be ready no later than 31st of December 2004. So within 6 years of delay. Now, if you look at the cause of this, maybe the reason may be a misunderstanding. And we may be looking at the wrong way of handling it. And I think we have in front of ourselves the picture of a city, this at the back of the stage, where we have the metaphor that we might probably want to look at. The internet is just like city. We have to do the city planning for this. There must be a process. The absence of the process or the internal delaying of the process is absolutely deadly. Could you imagine a city where there's no decision is going to be taken until we have the perfect thing available for any construction whatsoever to be allowed? Imagine what the city would look like. Now, it also leads us to ideas how the process should be run. If we are not ready with the process as it is right now, if there are concerns, specifically on the trademark side, about externalities. I'm happy that this word finally made it to the vocabulary they'd be using it, about the external cost that being excessive, not bearable for certain parties, then why don't we put this as an objection? Why don't we introduce an additional filter rather than stop the entire process and say there is going to be an externalities objection. We have objective grounds on which a specific proposal that was reasonably regarded as not acceptable, two parties are going to be affected. And we can have actually in the models that we see in rural planning exactly the same thing. If a new street or a new road is constructed, people can complain about emissions and that kind of stuff. So we've got something very similar. It's not just about rights or collisions. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a good comment. So I really want to thank everybody for sticking here and all the time you've invested in this and all the energy you've put into this process. So thanks very much. Have a great meeting, okay?